Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Do join Scripture scholar Archbishop Mark Coleridge, who tells us about a giant figure from our family tree of faith, Moses.
Let me start by saying that there's very much more of Moses in each one of us than we usually think. So what I'd like to do is to introduce you to this very grand forebear of ours, the liberator and the lawgiver. Now, sometimes we think of Moses as the archetypal Jew, or perhaps as some kind of Charlton Heston with a big beard and an even bigger staff in his hand, looming over the Red Sea in heroic style. But the fact is that Moses would have looked and sounded very much more Egyptian than Jewish. His name, in fact, Moses, is itself Egyptian. And there are lots of traces of Egypt in the stories we find about him in the Bible. Even the Ten Commandments read very like the rules of entrance inscribed on the doors of Egyptian temples. Now, this is because he was raised in the royal court, found in the bulrushes, raised in the court, very much a man of the establishment, probably speaking with a plum in his mouth, although with a stutter, it seems. Certainly he wasn't a good speaker, he says that himself. So he's not the kind of man you'd expect to be a liberator. But the princeling seems to have had a ferocious temper, and eventually he turns killer. He murders an Egyptian who was terrorizing one of the Hebrews, his own people, whom Moses seems never to have forgotten completely. In fact, Moses seems to have had a kind of identity crisis of the kind not unknown today, deciding that he was really a Hebrew rather than an Egyptian, no matter how he looked or how he sounded. At this point, the killer takes to the hills and becomes a shepherd, which must have been tough for the courtier, learning the ways of the desert. But then, after the burning bush, he reappears at court as the liberator, stamping his foot and demanding freedom for those whom he now calls my people. Caught then between the devil and the deep Red Sea, the waters open, and through they charge to freedom, you know the story. Only then to find themselves wandering in the wilderness, feeling that God has led them not up the garden path, but up the desert path, wanting to go back to Egypt, where at least, they say, we had roast dinners with leeks and cucumbers. For decades, Moses had to put up with his people's whinging, despite everything that he had done for them. As the old poem puts it, Moses was the leader of the Israelitic flock. He used to get spar water by just tapping on a rock. One day from out the multitude there came a mighty cheer. Instead of getting water, he got pints of ice-cold beer. But the cheers, I'm afraid, ran out with the beer, and the whinging went on. The man of a ferocious temper had to learn the way of patience. That was his journey. The man of faith also had his doubts out in the desert, which is why, having struck the rock not once but twice, he's told that he'll see but never enter the promised land. As he lay dying on the mountains of Moab in modern-day Jordan, looking across the Dead Sea to the promised land, Moses must have been dismayed by the moonscape that he saw. He must have wondered if God couldn't perhaps have done better than this. Perhaps he even thought back to the soft life of Egypt. But then breathed his last with not a hint of regret, because he had in fact made the greatest journey of all. Today there's not a trace of the tomb of Moses. Fascinating that. Not a trace of it. Because in fact he's buried everywhere, especially in our hearts.
You were listening there to Scripture scholar, Archbishop of Canberra and Goulburn in Australia, Mark Coleridge. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.